From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Megan Mack. Our connection this hour was made on Thursday nights, when families across the country would gather around their television sets to watch their favorite programs. Maybe this sounds like we're talking about the 1950s with shows like I Love Lucy and The Honeymooners. It could be, but the same rang true, and even more so, in the mid-1980s and the 1990s, the so-called era of must-see TV. Once upon a time, there was what we called appointment viewing, and NBC was reaping the benefits of that with shows like Cheers, The Cosby Show, then Seinfeld, Friends, and Will and Grace. It was the shining age of the sitcom, and as Jenny Jaffe wrote for The Washington Post, you wouldn't dare hit the water cooler without having at least a familiarity with those shows. Well, time has passed and viewing habits have changed. Now content is everywhere on Netflix, online, and on your phone, leaving many people to ask, is the network sitcom dying? But what about the return of shows like Will and Grace, Roseanne, Murphy Brown, and others, and talks about a possible return of Seinfeld? So where are we as TV viewers? Are we caught in some kind of content and technological purgatory? And what are our predictions for the future? My guest will help us answer those questions this hour. Joining me in studio, Todd Sedano, Associate Professor of Media and Communication and Director of the Film and Television Studies Program at St. John Fisher College. Welcome to you.
Thanks, Megan. Good to be here.
Katie Livy is a freelance writer and pop culture enthusiast. Thanks for joining the show.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
My colleague Juan Vasquez is here from down the hall. He had nothing better to do, so he decided to come in and talk about TV. He's our digital engagement facilitator here at WXXI News. Nice to see you.
I had exactly 58 minutes to spare, so.
Well, thank you for
being here. Good seeing you.
And joining us on the phone is Joy Press. She's the author of a new book called Stealing the Show About Women in Television. Thanks for joining us, Joy.
Hey, thank you.
Listeners, you can join this conversation by calling 844-295-TALK. That's 844-295-8255. Or if you're in Rochester, 263-WXXI. That's 263-9994. You can email the program at connections@wxxi.org. And you can find me on Twitter at mmacmedia. So I'll just start by asking my guests a very basic question. Is the sitcom dying? Todd.
We have 4 hours for this, right? It's a really complicated question. And the thing with television today is nothing is dead. Nothing is dying. Everything is able to be resuscitated and revived and enjoy some kind of rebirth. We get to see that tonight with Roseanne. So, yes, it's dead, but put an asterisk next to it because it'll come back in some life form sometime soon.
It's resurrecting.
Yeah.
Okay, I like the answer. Juan, is the sitcom dead? Do you agree or disagree with Todd?
Is the sitcom dead or are we running out of ideas? That could be another way of looking at it. And you know, Todd was talking about things being resurrected, and we've seen Roseanne be resurrected. We've seen One Day at a Time be resurrected, and we've seen a couple of others, Will and Grace, become resurrected. And sometimes I sort of ask myself the question, did we run out of ideas? Or are we trying to like pull on the strings of nostalgia just a little bit in order to make a quick buck? What is it, you know, what is it that we're doing? So I don't know if it's dead. I don't think it's dead. I think that it just keeps on evolving. And I think we're probably going to talk about that a little bit later on. It's evolving, but is it? It's also devolving a little bit too, because we keep going back to the same ideas. Movies have the same problem too, but it seems like we keep going back to the same ideas over and over.
Katie, what do you think?
I don't think it's dead. I think it's an interesting question to look at network sitcoms versus streaming sitcoms too. I mean, like, you know, you're looking at this is where people used to watch them all the time, was on ABC, NBC, things like that. And now we have Netflix and Hulu and all those different places to watch it. So it could evolve in a different way without a laugh track.
We will talk about laugh tracks in this hour, absolutely. Joy, as you're listening to this conversation and thinking about your book, which you covered both types of sitcoms that Katie was just talking about, network sitcoms and those on Netflix and other platforms, what do you think? Do you think that the sitcom is dying, or do you agree with Todd in that things can be resurrected?
Well, I think your other guest sort of hit the nail on the head. I mean, I think there's two things going on. You're simultaneously seeing mostly networks trying to sort of resurrect the good old days when, you know, millions and millions of people were watching the same show. And so there's a nostalgia for that. And then I think on the other side of it, you're seeing other platforms that are kind of reinventing the sitcom and with, you know, much more openness in terms of structure. You know, some of the best shows on TV are kind of just rethinking the whole idea of sitcom and comedy in general.
What are some examples of that?
I mean, I think, you know, a lot of the shows that I talk about that were created by women, you know, sort of are, you know, end up rethinking that format. And I'm just even thinking in terms of things like Crazy Ex-Girlfriend or you know, a show like Insecure on HBO, you know, I mean, Broad City kind of takes huge liberties with the comedy format, and I think, you know, these are shows that you know, could not have made it on the typical sort of network sitcom lineup.
And I think those shows, if I may jump in, series like Insecure, which is just wonderful, and Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, which is also just emotionally poignant, are probably characterized as comedies.
And not traditional sitcoms.
And not traditional
dramedies.
Sitcoms.
I mean, there's that new, you know, it's like the new format of dramedies kind of has in some ways surpassed the sitcom format on a lot of these other platforms.
So do we consider a comedy show, let's take The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt as an example. Is that considered a sitcom? Even though it's on Netflix, does that fall into the category of a sitcom?
I was a nerd and I looked up the definition of sitcom. And it was a humorous drama based on situations that might arise in day-to-day life. So if you look at kind of that scope of it, yeah, I would say Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt would definitely be one. But if you look at it kind of, when I think of a sitcom, I think of like TJAF when I was a kid, you know, like Full House and
Family Matters
and that whole thing where people were kind of like gathering around the television and watching four shows in a row that were the content that you can play with a show like Broad City or something like that wouldn't fly. It would be for a specific audience. But yeah.
So is it the content that determines whether it's a sitcom or not, or the platform? In today's society, because if we look at that definition, a show like Kimmy Schmidt would be a sitcom, and so would other shows on Netflix that don't have sort of the same feel. But
I think the cultural practices obviously have shifted. What you perceived or remembered to be TGIF or watching Golden Girls growing up, that was a different time period for all of us. But for something now, today's kids who are watching TV, they don't have that let's gather around the TV to watch the new episode of blank.
So let's use a sitcom technique and go back in time to 2014.
Is it one of those episodes?
I don't have. I know. I was going to say I don't
when
have any.
They ran
music
out of ideas.
every like fifth episode of The Golden Girls. Okay, 2014. Going back in time, Vulture published a piece titled "Network TV is Suffering Through a Great Sitcom Recession," and it chronicled NBC's struggle with The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt because that show had been filmed at that time. It was waiting to be aired, but then NBC cut the cord and ceded custody and sent the show to Netflix. Or sold the show to Netflix. And even though the show was backed by Tina Fey, big at NBC, big across the industry, NBC said that the show would have no chance of making it on network television because the network itself didn't have a single sitcom hit in the years preceding it. So that year, it also gave Parks and Rec a send-off. Over at CBS, Will Arnett's show The Millers was canceled just 2 weeks into its second season. And that show was scheduled right after The Big Bang Theory, which was a monster hit, but people just weren't sticking around. So across networks in 2014 and 2015 as well, sitcoms just not making it. In 2014, only 9 of the most 50 watched network programs were sitcoms. 9 of 50, I should say. But if you go back to 1995, when sitcoms accounted for 38 of the top 50 network programs, different landscape. So lots of questions there. How much of this is a result of the availability of content, do you all think? With the rise of Netflix and digital streaming platforms, how much of this shift can we blame on technology?
I thought you were going to say, how much of this is NBC's fault for relinquishing a Tina Fey property?
Listen, NBC.
Right.
It was pretty obvious that was going to be a bona fide hit as soon as NBC let it go.
Yeah.
How much of that was also just the direction NBC was going, too? I mean, NBC has a lot of dramas, And that, it seems to be, is their big play now, is drama. So back in the 80s, early 90s, it was comedies, and now it seems to be dramas. And it seems now that there's this shift that, you know, ABC's now got some comedies and CBS has some comedies. And how much of that was just NBC making, you know, stupid excuse to say we're not going to put this because it's not going to fit anywhere in what we're doing right now?
And that
well,
was
I would also
oh, sorry,
point
Joy.
Out that 30 Rock was not actually a massive ratings hit for NBC. And, you know, it was a very smart, weird comedy. It really doesn't fit the typical network sitcom mold that a huge swath of Americans can sit down and watch at the same time. And so some of it was kind of shifting tastes and, you know, 30 Rock, in retrospect, is more of a cable comedy. It really doesn't fit that sort of, you know, one-size-fits-all kind of sitcom format that networks had before. So I think some of it is just a shift in how we watch TV and sort of the nicheification. Is that a word? I just made up a word. The
like
nicheification of television comedy.
But also I think, I don't know that we could even have or develop any kind of sitcom that would appeal to everybody at this point. You know, I think that we have such a diverse audience watching that, and you can't really get away with a lot of the stuff that you got to get away with, you know, back in the heyday of, you know, situation comedies. I don't know that there's a one-size-fits-all solution, you know. Now.
Can I ask you to follow up on that? What do you mean you can't get away with as much?
I would say in terms of, I guess, as a society, let's see. So, you know, I guess the family dynamic almost. I think looking, the kind of modern family has changed. I'm not using modern family as an excuse because I don't. but, you know, going back to that kind of explosion of sitcom popularity with something like a TJIF show, I think that a lot more families could sit down and watch it and kids could sit down and watch it. And I don't know the kids are really watching network television anymore.
Right. I was just going to say, do kids want to sit down with their parents and watch a show at a specific time every week?
Yeah.
No, from my observations in the classroom, the answer is no. And when they're watching it, they're watching it in binges with their families through various iterations of something like a Modern Family.
Yeah.
And that could be a lowercase Modern Family.
Or are they watching it on Hulu later by themselves? Or, you know, right. They're not really kind of sitting down watching it together.
Right. The way that we watch as individuals and as a country, as a world, has changed. Technology has changed it, and I think it's really hard to go back. And I think that becomes really complicated for the networks, whose system is built on mass numbers, whereas these other platforms, and there are more and more platforms all the time crowding the market, they're sort of built on niches and, you know, a little bit more narrow sensibility. So it works much better for them, and the networks are busy struggling trying to figure out how do you go back to getting, you know, 50 million people to sit down and laugh at the same time.
And to piggyback off of that, Joy, the networks are relying on that habituation too, that you're going to tune in every Thursday at 9 o'clock to watch Seinfeld.
Right.
And young people, they don't see television that way. They don't even see television in terms of networks. Just the nomenclature that they use to describe television now is not about network. It's season, it's episode, it's anything that's bingeable or on their streaming devices.
So is that a realistic goal that networks should have at this point? It seems like everyone's on the same page with appointment viewing has gone. So why are the networks still pushing for that? Should they be more open-minded to different opportunities? Or is that just the platform as it is and they have to try to live in the past to influence their future?
Just kind of
well, milking. You know, I mean, you see CBS kind of, you know, trying to kind of get into this new world with the Good Fight, and you know, there are definitely attempts at experimentation. But on the other side, you also see the rebooting of these classic shows as a way to kind of reawaken that that dormant idea of appointment television. And, you know, and certainly that's one reason, you know, reality TV was really worked for them. You know, shows that you wanted to see live because otherwise it would get spoiled.
Hmm. Looking at CBS, huge success with The Big Bang Theory. That's probably, if you think about the most successful traditional sitcom out there right now, that's probably it. What is it about that show that stands out? I know you either love that show or you hate that show, it seems. But what is it about The Big Bang Theory that helps it stand out from the pack?
I don't know, because I honestly, I've watched it. I've tried. And
you
it's
don't like
just,
it.
I can see the appeal, I guess, but sitting down to watch that show every week just would not happen. I don't know.
I don't. I mean, I like the show. I mean, I'm not going to say that I love the show. If it's on, I'm going to watch it. Some of that is could also be, you know, it's in syndication now, so people are seeing it more often too. So maybe they now start to correlate with the fact that, you know, they're going to watch the new episodes that are going on right now. But I think part of it is also they. The dynamic that they got from what how the characters were in the beginning of the series is now completely different, and they've sort of fallen into, in a way, the traditional sitcom-y type of, you know, things that they've got to deal with. And I guess maybe people love the characters so much that they actually don't mind that the shift has been going on throughout, you know, the run of the series. But I don't know. Is it the fact that it's such a fantastic show, or is everything else such crap that ends up being number one? So, you know, mediocre becomes number one because everything else sucks, you know? So, I mean, that could be it,
but
too.
But everything doesn't. This is such a great time for TV, right? I mean, if you look at something like even Big Bang, of which I'm not a fan, avowedly, you guys heard me say that before air.
Why?
Today. It's not Seinfeld or Golden Girls, Juan.
And
maybe our callers will
friends.
Educate us.
Yes.
Something about that world that they've created, which is really special, I think, to viewers, which is it appeals to them somehow. I'm remembering Wendell Pierce, who played Bunk in The Wire. He said one time that the more specific the story is, the more universal it becomes. And I think something like that, something like Big Bang, is so specific, so nichified, Joy, that all of a sudden it becomes universal to everybody, and it shoots its way up to the top.
And how much of this is like Chuck Lorre and who's his other partner? That have written, they wrote Two and a Half Men. They've now wrote Big Bang Theory. They
Modern
wrote
Family
Mom.
Too, right? Young
yeah,
Sheldon.
Which, by the way, actually, no, Modern Family was
Steve Levitan.
Levitan, yeah, sorry.
And then they wrote Mom, which I love, by the way.
Yeah,
I absolutely
Mom was good.
Love that show. Somehow have been able to capture what people like in a series.
Well,
I don't know how and I don't know why.
I have a theory.
Okay.
And
is it a Big Bang Theory?
It is a Big Bang. We need a laugh track, Rob. Help me out here. Is it a Big Bang Theory? There we go.
Yeah,
there you go, Juan.
I feel validated.
Can we get the trombone after the bad joke like Juan made?
I didn't pull that one. That's for kissing. No one's kissing.
Is that from Saved by the Bell?
No, that was from Family Matters, actually. My theory is that people are drawn to the characters, and they just love the relationship that the characters have, and they feel like they're part of a family. I am not a huge fan of that show, but Brian in Rochester is, and he wants to tell us why he loves Big Bang Theory. So here's Brian. Go ahead.
Oh, hi, everybody. Thanks for letting me be on the show. I've listened all the time. My family, we love this show. We have watched The Big Bang Theory since it started, from the character progression all the way through them being just this house full of geeks and nerds that really don't understand anything, all the way up to everyone getting married and moving on. And we actually, we still kind of watch it together as a family, both in syndication and when it's on. And we watch it every week when it's new. And then we talk about it over text. It's kind of bizarre. I have a Sheldon shirt. I have a Sheldon thumb drive that sits in my computer where his head pops off. So I know there's a lot of hate for The Big Bang Theory, especially on the internet, especially on Reddit. But I think it was just a great sitcom that went from this very auspicious beginning of four nerdy guys in California that has moved on, and we've gotten to watch them grow. And also, there's a whole bunch that Levitan and Chuck do in the background that people don't know about. Like, the DNA model changes every week. It's like a new molecular structure that's different every week. So if you're kind of a dork and you're into all that, plus we're sci-fi nerds. So, sorry, I just wanted to talk on the radio.
First, it's hard to impress anybody on Reddit to begin with, number one. But also, how much of that is... You know, it's a general audience, and then you get some that actually get some of the things that they're actually trying to do. So it's like general audience, and then you get it's Then the people that can take it a little bit more advanced understand maybe some of the nuances of the jokes. The ones that can actually absolutely get it and you think that that's the audience that they're going for hate it because they feel like they're being pandered to.
Hmm. I have a friend who has a friend who writes for that show or did at one point, and he said every episode was very formulaic in terms of percentages. So a certain percentage of sex jokes, a certain percentage of science jokes that only some people would get, as you said, one. And then I think the other percentage was like miscellaneous silly things, but...
But that's like most comedies, right? Three jokes to a page, 1 minute of screen time per page. I mean, that part's not groundbreaking. And if Brian's still on air, I still want to hear from him. Brian, you still there?
Go ahead, Brian.
I am still here.
Brian, all right. Now, you sound like fanboy, but I want to hear more about why. I still don't get the why. What's the allure for Big Bang Theory? And it's not hatred. It's not antipathy on my part.
Sure. I don't know if it's... we started watching it early on. I am I'm not a scientist, but I am kind of a nerd. I'm a sci-fi Star Trek fanboy, so the Will Wheaton stuff really kind of I enjoy. I also am 47 years old. I grew up with, situational comedies and must-see TV and all that. But I also grew up with Newhart, so I think they cater the formulas that they use. Obviously, is there sex jokes and there's science and there's all this, but they also harken back. They pulled in some people that were some actors and some names that were such an integral part of my youth growing up in front of the television. Sorry, Mom. like Bob Newhart and Will Wheaton and Christine Baranski, and just all of a sudden every couple of months they'd introduce a new character that was someone that I'd seen on television for 30 or 40 years. Which was kind of neat. Stephen Hawking and his whole character arc where Sheldon's trying to figure out whether he wants to get married. So instead of calling his own mother, he calls Stephen Hawking. I mean, just weird things like that, which are kind of geeky and nerdy and sciencey, but also I think everyone wants to be able to have someone just, I'm having some relationship challenges. Who am I going to call? The most intelligent man on the planet. That's kind of neat. So I think that's kind of why we like it. And it's silly and it's fluffy and you don't have to think too hard. And I think with everything going on in the world, that's super important for people to be able to have a half an hour where you can be like, all right, this is just kind of fluffy and weird.
Okay. I understand that.
Answer.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks, Brian. Thanks for calling in. We're down to our last few minutes with Joy. So Joy, I want to have you jump in here. And from the broad landscape, do you see any potential for must-see TV ever returning? NBC might be trying to do that with Will and Grace now and other shows that it's packing into Thursday nights. But with all the research you've done, do you think that that's a possibility?
Well, I mean, of course, it's always a possibility. It's a moment where everything's kind of in chaos in the TV landscape. And I feel like we are going to see in the next couple of years an even sort of bigger kind of battle for viewers and for eyes. And, I think like Disney and Apple are kind of going to jump into the space. And so, the networks really have a very short amount of time to figure this out. I mean, they still have a lot of viewers and they have a lot of good shows, but, it's really the kind of the moment for them to do some experimenting and figure out what they're going to look like, in the next decade. And I think that's going to play out in the next couple of years. I think it's very possible. And as I said, there's still plenty of things that I watch on network television, but the number of kind of must-see shows is dwindling. And, there's only so much you can reboot before people just want to, turn the remote.
Before I let you go, Joy, what is your favorite sitcom of all time?
Wow, that's really hard. I've been talking a lot about the Mary Tyler Moore Show, and I think, that's really a classic that I think I probably watched in reruns as a kid. But that, in some ways feels to me like a really kind of perfect sitcom. And since Roseanne is returning tonight, I will also say that, I think that is certainly the original. I haven't seen the new one, but the original Roseanne was an absolutely fantastic show.
We are going to talk about Roseanne, and perhaps, if our listeners don't mind, play a small, small cut from that show. It'll be a spoiler alert, so we've got that in the can ready to go about Roseanne. But I'm late for our only break, so we'll take our short break. We'll come back. We'll take Keith's phone call, and we'll talk more about the death or resurrection of sitcoms with our guests, Todd Sodano, Katie Libby, Juan Vasquez, and Joy Press joining us on the phone. She's the author of Stealing the Show. Check it out. It's a great book, especially if you want to learn more about women in television. Thank you so much for joining us, Joy.
Thanks for having me. It was fun.
Sure. All right, listeners, short break. More Connections next. I'm Megan Mack. Wednesday on The Next Connections, how do architecture and urban design relate to climate change? The Reshaping Rochester series continues this week, and speaker Mark Dawson joins us to talk about how to translate ideas into tangible designs that can potentially save lives and improve our environment. Then in our second hour, a preview of Jiva Theater's 46th season. Talk to you Wednesday. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Megan Mack, sitting in for Evan Dawson today. We're talking about sitcoms, the life, the death, the resurrection, whatever you perceive that to be. And we'll get to your phone calls in just a moment. Listeners, you can call the program at 844-295-TALK. That's 844-295-8255. Or if you're in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Up first on the phones is Keith in Victor. Go ahead, Keith.
Megan, how you doing?
Great. Go ahead, Keith. Hi.
Okay. A couple things. Sitcoms in the 50s really didn't represent what life was. Everything was perfect. You never had a problem. You're talking Father's Knows Best, Donna Reed, Leave It to Beaver. Then all of a sudden you had All in the Family. And people figured out, well, let's show sitcoms that represent people in real life, which they did with All in the Family and the spinoffs from it. Even Golden Girl, I believe, was part of All in the Family. And then you have Cable comes along. So Cable can take it even further because there's no censorship. Now, I've seen Sex and the City on network TV and reruns that was heavily censored to the point where you didn't quite get the plot until you watch it on DVD, where it fills in the loose or the empty spots. Now, a program like Shameless, I don't know if anybody has seen that. It's really good, and it's on, we watch it on Netflix, but it could never, ever be put on network TV because of the swearing, even the plot lines, which I think are all good. But on the downside of Netflix is I think they gave birth to a Fuller House. And sadly, I got stuck watching that once. And I was and I'm not a religious person, but I was praying so hard for the dragons from Game of Thrones to fly in and just fry everybody. But that program, it's silly. And I think some of the comedies from the early 50s were just silly and didn't really reflect life. Where the newer ones, say, from All in the Family on, try to reflect life. And that's why you can relate to characters from The Big Bang Theory. And I like the TV program Life in Pieces, where they have four little stories. Mm-hmm. I can associate. I can relate to some of those people.
Okay.
But again, that's just my opinion.
Yeah, thanks, Keith. I'll let our guest respond to that. I have to fact check you, though, because you have big Golden Girls fans in the room. And I don't think Golden Girls was a spinoff of All in the Family. No. I think you're thinking of Maude, which starred Bea Arthur, who was in the Golden Girls.
Yes, and the Jeffersons was also a spinoff of All in the Family.
That's right. See, that's why we have Juan here.
That's right.
That's why he's not doing actual work today. I'm just kidding. But what do you think about that? Keith, talking about escapism and shows like the 50s, where the characters and the situations are not really like real life. It's this idyllic look at society. And then today, we find ourselves possibly identifying more with what we're seeing on TV. What's the value in that, Todd?
Well, that's where television went, right? In the late 60s and early 70s, where we got to see those kinds of programs reflecting a little more of what was going on in our culture at the times. We still have programs like that today, but we also have series that still serve that escapist purpose for us. And those will continue to be there. There's so much to unpack with what Keith just said on the phone there, because we're also talking about distribution models. We're really badgering the networks here. But they don't play by the same rules as the cable channels do, as the streaming channels do, the ones who are free from any FCC regulation for content. The networks are able to do some of that stuff, some of that cutting edge stuff, but that, of course, is during the safe harbor hours between 10 p.m. and 6 a.m. Cable and streaming, they could do that any hour of the day that they want to, which is why Shameless can be as cutting edge as it is.
And some cable networks do try to follow those FCC rules in a sense. They don't have to, but they put some of that, more adult content later on in the hours. But it's interesting because we're talking about the networks and we're talking about, some of the things that they're doing and the fact that they may have to change maybe their models a little bit. And I feel like the cable networks are not immune to this anymore because of the streaming networks, too. And I think that now having more channels and more studios, you've got Netflix in there, you've got Amazon in there now, you've got Hulu jumping in, you've got YouTube jumping in now. There's more content creators, which could be good or bad. You've got more channels to put the stuff out, which could be good or bad. But it really does hamper, the cable networks, and it also hampers the regular television networks to kind of figure out what is it that they're going to be doing going forward. Is it they're going to be creating their own stuff? Are they going to be maybe places where they're going to put things for maybe a season and then move on and put something else in that place and then move there? Move that existing show over to their own streaming service? Are they going to start charging for that streaming service like CBS did? And I'd be really interested to figure out how many people are actually subscribing to that, because I'm not paying you another $5.99 on top of everything else that I'm paying just to go watch Star Trek or just to go watch
The Price
is Right.
I know those people that will pay for Star Trek.
You know, I might pay for The Price is Right, but that's about it. So it's thanks.
Thanks, Rob.
But it's really interesting because now you're going to have a lot of places to watch content. You're going to have a lot of these studios that are going to be creating content. And if you make more of this stuff, is anything going to be good or is it just going to be mediocre? And maybe the best of the mediocre rises to the top.
But you're talking about quality. The networks don't care about that quality. They want to make sure that that series is at the top of the ratings. They want to make sure that it's maybe a zeitgeisty show that can get buzz attention, that can get awards, that can get critical praise, and so on and so forth. If you're talking about quality, I imagine the networks could honestly give a good darn.
So are they not testing things enough to be, because throwing shows into the lineup, like The Millers is a great example, they canceled that weeks into the second season. A season is not very long. There are shows, look at Cheers back in the 80s. That was doing terribly, but they decided to give it a chance.
It was last. It was the first week in 1982.
Yep.
So how do you know? Does something have potential and we need to let it sit a little longer? Or are we ripping the cord out too early?
You had less choices then, too. Remember that.
That's true.
I mean, when Cheers was on, what other choices did you have? And Cheers was what, 82?
82.
Yeah, right? Yeah. So what were the other choices you had? You barely had HBO at the time. You had CBS and you had ABC. Maybe an independent channel if you were in a larger city. That's about it. And read a book or read the paper. They didn't have that many choices.
That's the bad paradox. With this plethora of options now that have proliferated, they're becoming increasingly impatient.
Right.
Right? The example I talk about in class all the time is Lone Star, which was a series on Fox. Fox was looking to hang its hat on it in the fall of 2010. It was a one-hour drama series on Monday nights, which was up against Monday Night Football. And instantly, that was pulled. After two episodes, they canceled the entire series. I mean, can you imagine Cheers just being canceled after one episode, two episodes?
Right.
Unthinkable.
Here's Eric jumping in on Twitter. He says, I watch sitcoms almost exclusively. I think their perceived failure is due to declining broadcast views weighed against the cost to produce, the same reason reality took over 15 to 20 years ago. Great network sitcoms are on right now. The Good Place, Brooklyn Nine-Nine, Fresh Off the Boat. The latter two have done great things for diversity and representation on TV, and that's just network. Cable sitcoms are pushing the format in new directions in other ways.
I just was watching an interview with Andy Samberg from Brooklyn Nine-Nine, and they don't know right now whether they're going to be canceled next season. So they're filming another season, and then their last episode, they don't know whether they're going to end it or whether they have to keep going. And this is something they're not telling even the actors that are on the show. So it just seems to be this last-minute kind of decision that the network is making whether to pull it or not.
Yeah, they're on the whim of the network, which, you know, if they had a little bit more pull, or if they were on a cable network, they may not have that whim. And one of the things I think about in that sense was like Curb Your Enthusiasm, you know, with Larry David. They did, what, 8 seasons of that show? And now the 9th season comes out how many years after? You know,
and
they've been trying to get him to come back. You would never see an over-the-air network even try something like that, except maybe for Seinfeld. That's probably be it. But you would never see. Or, well, Will and Grace, yeah. But I don't think that they were, like, begging them to come back year after year after year after year. There's only a few shows that I think you'd be able to do that. And with, you know, Will and Grace was probably one of those shows that they'd be able to do that. And I don't know how it's doing now. I don't know how it's doing in viewership or if anybody's, you know, watching it now. I know it got gangbuster ratings the first time. What is it, you know, what
is
it doing after
just
that?
The excitement of them being back?
It could
be. I don't know the numbers.
I don't know the numbers. I know they renewed it. And you'll see great numbers, I imagine, for Roseanne tonight.
Right.
The true test will be, what, the second episode.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, right. I'm very excited for it, but I don't know that it's going to be the same as it was originally.
This might be the epitome of appointment viewing now, is this thing is back one time, and that's it.
Well, the reviews for Roseanne have been mixed. I read one that was very good and one that was more critical. Critic David Bianculli he was on Fresh Air. So he was on NPR this morning, I believe. He says, the new Roseanne is good, but nowhere near required viewing. And he was talking about how the original was groundbreaking at the time. It was aggressively different. And its leading character was Roseanne. It was a woman. It was a matriarch leading a family. The family itself, bickering all the time, very different from The Cosby Show, which was on at the same time. And also it focused on working class issues. So now the show's back. We've seen it done before. How can it stand out in this era? I have a clip that we can play from Roseanne. And I will say to our listeners, this is a spoiler alert. This is how they address the, hey, Dan was dead before we, that's how the show ended. Dan had died. So here's a clip from the new one, which will air tonight. Don't listen if you want to be surprised.
Dan!
What happened?
I thought you were dead.
I'm sleeping. Why does everybody always think I'm dead?
You looked happy. I thought maybe you moved on.
So, new clip from Roseanne. What will it take for Roseanne to be successful this time around, Katie?
Oh, boy. That's a hard... I don't know, because, you know, they're kind of marketing it as she's going to be a Trump supporter. Whereas, you know, that's kind of the voice of the working class, or he, you know, advertised himself as such. And I think, and they're bringing a lot more diversity into the show this time, kind of harkening back to older episodes with DJ and things like that. You know, I don't know. Like I said before, I don't know how popular this one is going to be. You know, I want it to, I'm excited for it, but I'm not sure.
It depends on which Becky's back.
Both
Beckys.
But I think a lot of this, and there's been a lot of stuff that's been made about her being a Trump supporter. There was not a lot of political stuff in the last show.
Right.
All right. So if they're going to be harking on this whole, you know, she's going to be a Trump supporter, that's going to die right away. But a lot of what at least I saw with Roseanne being the success.
Why do you think it'll die right away?
It's not that I didn't say that it was because she's a Trump supporter. If this is all going to be political jokes.
Oh, if it's okay, I see what you're saying.
And we're going to have a political bent to this, it's not going to work. The last show did not. It dealt with the issues, and it dealt with the snarky ways in which they would sometimes try to deal with those issues. Especially, you know, the girls and DJ were being brats, and she would just, you know, go off on them. And you know, sometimes the snarky way that she would deal with those issues were what made the show funny and what made the show enlightening. And then towards the end of the show, you know, everything was sort of resolved, kind of in a sense, you know, in a way that only Roseanne could do. So I think it just deals with, if they can deal with the family issues that they had dealt with before, they can deal with in sort of like that Roseanne snark that she's always dealt with them. I think that the show will actually do well.
I think what Juan's talking about, obviously, is good storytelling.
Yeah.
Right? If the comedy and the drama and these stories are rooted in good character, the Arnolds being that family, I think it might have that ability to do something like All in the Family had done 20 years before it.
And then the jokes are punchy enough that, you know, coincide with having to deal with that stuff, storytelling. I think it'll work well. I think a lot of people are making too much of, you know, her being a Trump supporter. And if that's what the focus of the writing is going to be on, you're dead in the water. I did not call for that.
Thank you, Rob Braden, for that. Here's Mona on Twitter. She says, I fail to understand why we are constantly rebooting old shows. Is it a lack of creativity, trying to pull my age group back into television and away from Netflix and Hulu? Todd, you're saying no.
I'm agreeing. We have this insatiable itch to have that nostalgia scratched for us instead of just moving on. I don't know what the cause is. Go ahead.
Was it one of the big surprises I had, which was I thought was a reboot and actually ended up being more of a homage to the original, was Glow. I don't know if you saw Glow on Netflix. I was excited when Glow came back because I was like, man, I grew up on Glow. I remember watching, you know, Gorgeous Ladies of Wrestling. And it was a completely different take on Gorgeous Ladies of Wrestling, which was talking about the creation of Gorgeous Ladies of Wrestling. So it was a reboot in a sense, but it was almost like a reimagination of Glow, and it went into a different direction. So it took the name, but then went into a different direction, but still stayed with somewhat the storyline of the 80s wrestling show, which I absolutely loved. So I thought that was like a brilliant way of trying to revive a name and still sticking with the original story that it was about.
I think if you look at the example of Full House, I mean, you know, I was, I think, 8 or 9 years old when that show was on and I was watching it. Now I'm 37 and they did it on Netflix. And, you know, it was cheesy back in the day, but I was 8 and cheesy was amazing. And now it's the same. They haven't developed or anything. Right. It's the same show, the same cheesy jokes. And I'm just not, I'm a different person now. You know,
that's what's probably like happening is they're thinking you're not. You're the same person who's going to ooh and ah and laugh at the same how rude kind of jokes from Full House or Fuller House. And Glow, that's the exception that proves the rule, which is these are these reboots that we're talking about that seem to be pandering to those people who watched that 10, 20, 30 years ago. And what's problematic about that pandering is it's insulting. It's not going to catch that lightning in a bottle that Roseanne once did 30 years ago or that Full House did 25 years ago.
This is Richie on Twitter, and he says, sitcoms with laugh tracks must die. Let's talk about laugh tracks, because I have a couple clips we can listen to. But first, I want to go around the room. What are your thoughts on laugh tracks, Todd?
This is public broadcasting, so
it
I
is.
Can't
Please
say
watch
four
your
letter
language.
Words. Okay.
Tiana has a dump button back there. So.
I just don't like them. They are inauthentic. They are artificial, and they don't belong in television anymore. Go back 20 years. There's a beautiful Sports Night piece, the ABC short-lived Aaron Sorkin sitcom, where ABC forced him to put in a laugh track for that kind of a show. They weren't ready for that kind of a series at this point, and this was 20 years ago, and that led to ultimately its demise. Laugh tracks are terrible. Not to sack the deck again to you guys.
Katie, what do you think about laugh tracks?
I hate them. Yeah, I mean, there was a show on Netflix that was like a stoner comedy with Kathy Bates, and I was like, this is going to be great. Like, she's operating a dispensary. Turned it on, and there's a laugh track. And I'm like, why? Why do we have a laugh track on a Netflix show about a week? I don't know. I turned it off.
Was it used ironically?
No.
Juan, laugh track.
Yeah, I think a lot of the comedies that you find out now probably don't need a laugh track, especially if they're written well. The laugh tracks, I find myself watching a lot of older shows that have laugh tracks, and you find yourself not even realizing that there's a laugh track there, in a sense. And I think probably because the writing was good at that time. But I don't know if they're actually going to enhance anything now like they did then. I know, you know, Big Bang Theory still uses a laugh track, and there's times I find myself laughing along with the laugh track or before the laugh track even happens. I think that it's overused now. You probably don't need it anymore. But if you're taping in front of a live audience, why not just use the audience and not a laugh track? Which I think you find some shows actually did. They actually did insert a laugh track. It was actually, you know, you can see different levels of laughing. It's not just a laugh track. There's actually different levels of laughing. You know, Seinfeld was one of them that, it was, there were different levels of laughing. There was no laugh track. The laughing was coming from the crowd.
Listeners, if you are a fan of laugh tracks, we want to hear from you. So call the program 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, and join our conversation about laugh tracks. And while we wait for you to call, because I hope you do, we're going to do a little experiment. I have a piece of The Big Bang Theory with a laugh track and then the same clip without the laugh track. What do we want to hear first, team? Without. All right, so Rob, we're going to play the no laugh track clip. This is from the Big Bang Theory episode, The Zazzy Substitution.
Ah, nothing makes beer taste better than cool, clear Rocky Mountain spring water. Where are the Rocky Mountains anyway?
Philadelphia.
Really? I thought they were out west someplace.
Think about it, Raj. Where did the movie Rocky take place?
Philadelphia. Okay, now I get it.
So this is the plan? From now on, we're just gonna hide out in here to avoid the shamey?
I'm very comfortable here. Penny, dear, why don't you shoot another silver bullet my way?
How are we all feeling right now?
Awkward.
I laughed at two of those jokes.
Okay.
I did laugh at the Rocky joke.
Okay.
You know, because, yeah, where was the film Rocky made? I mean, that was funny. I thought that was funny.
I sort of wish I had edited out the spaces where the laugh track had been so we could really challenge ourselves and see if we could have guessed. But, yeah, Todd.
But that stuff doesn't exist in a vacuum. Listen to the delivery, right? The actors pausing, the sound recording. I mean, there's so much that goes into it. That if they were just talking on stage, if they were talking on a film style shot, kind of sitcom, something more single camera style, like an Insecure, like Girls, you might have a different kind of delivery. The audio would sound different.
That's a great point. I never really thought about the delivery because they're teeing up the joke. Interesting. So let's listen to the clip with the laugh track.
Nothing makes beer taste better than cool, clear Rocky Mountain spring water. Where are the Rocky Mountains anyway?
Philadelphia.
Really? I thought they were out west someplace.
Think about it, Raj. Where did the movie Rocky take place?
Philadelphia. Okay, now I get it.
So this is the plan? From now on, we're just gonna hide out in here to avoid the shamey?
I'm very comfortable here. Penny, dear, why don't you shoot another silver bullet my way?
Katie, how do you feel with the laugh track?
I feel more at ease.
More at ease.
Yes.
I do, too. That's actually well said.
Yeah.
I don't feel like watching Big Bang Theory still.
No.
But I feel more at ease.
Okay. Juan.
Yeah. Feel less dirty. That's
it. Wow. Okay. Remember, it's a public radio program.
But, I know. But the laugh track is the equivalent of the musical score. The musical score is telling you how to feel.
Right.
And the laugh track is telling you here's when you should laugh. You're doing eight other things while you're watching that episode of Big Bang Theory, maybe. You should laugh now.
You don't want to be told what to do.
What are some good examples of sitcoms that rely on the musical score in order to tee up how you should feel? That you just made me think about that, Todd, because I'm sure there are shows out there. And we don't even notice that. It's so ingrained. It's so, you know, part of our viewing experience.
You know what shows did a really good job of that? And we had just already talked about them. Remember the TGIF shows? Remember when the resolution would come at the end of the episode?
Oh, yes.
The piano
how there was
music.
Always a piano music or something going on? They were really good at
As soon as Danny that. Tanner sits down next to the DJ.
Taking it down a notch.
Yeah, exactly.
Then you think about shows like How I Met Your Mother that had really cool stylistic elements. I'm not really a fan of that show personally. I had to write an episode when I was in college. But it was fun to play around with different ways of telling a story. And you can think about a musical score, but you can also think about flashbacks and things that Barney did. And I don't know. What do you think about that, Todd? Do you like that as a gimmick or do you see it as a valuable storytelling piece?
Which part?
The stylistic elements, the flashbacks, the... You know, the time
I think
dashes.
If it's done effectively, because if they are gimmicky, it's going to come off that way. But if it's something to continue the narrative, to proceed with story, to evolve characters better, absolutely go for it. And How I Met Your Mother did that really well.
30 Rock did too.
Until the end.
Mm-hmm. It's Always Sunny always does that too. And sometimes they do it from a transition and it keeps on going into the scene. Or sometimes it ends a scene. And it's usually with some sort of musical score that, you know, you should feel a certain way coming out of the joke or, you know, the end punchline of that scene. But they do a really good job of that, too.
And a lot of those shows, I mean, they had longevity, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they were around for almost a decade
there
plus.
Like 14 seasons now, I think.
Always Sunny,
for
right?
It's Always Sunny, yeah.
30 Rock, six, seven, or eight
yeah.
seasons.
Yeah.
How I Met Your Mother, I think nine seasons.
Mm-hmm.
And that could be a result of boredom. We've done the same thing over and over again. But then you see some of these other groundbreaking series on television, like Insecure, like Atlanta, and you realize, wow, these guys are just getting out of the gate, and they are breaking ground right. in this sort of storytelling.
Or you realize that they're actually decent shows, and they were written well, and the character development was good, too. I mean, I really think with It's Always Sunny, it's you never saw the characters. The characters have never evolved.
No.
I mean, the characters are still the same characters, sort of like The Simpsons in a way. You know,
right.
the characters are still the same characters. But the writing just is strong from season one all the way to season 14.
And that was like your show, Seinfeld, right?
Yeah.
What was their credo or creed?
Yeah.
No hugging, no learning.
No hugging, no learning.
No hugging, no learning.
Before,
I hadn't either. A lot of love for The Good Place on Twitter, Atlanta.
Good Place is good.
That's
a really funny show.
Let's see, Blackish, that keeps popping up. So, yeah, Speechless, Superstore, Modern Family.
Yeah, Blackish is hilarious. Superstore is fantastic.
I like The Goldbergs. That's one of
the Goldbergs is amazing, yes.
But that's the good way of doing that nostalgia mm-hmm.
yes.
kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, it's a perfect example of putting in a time and a place, and that's where it is. It's in the 80s. You're not trying to evoke an 80s mm-hmm. feeling, you know what I mean, in a present way, like Full House kind of story.
And a lot of those shows don't have laugh tracks.
Right, yeah.
And they've created a world much like Glow. Goldberg's feels like it's taking place in 1980s mm-hmm. Philadelphia. Glow feels like it'd be taking place yeah. during that kind of a period.
Well, we'll see what happens with the network sitcom and the future of television as we continue to go on our television journey. I'd like to thank all my guests, Todd Sodano, Katie Libby, Juan Vasquez, and then earlier on the phone, Joy Press. Thank you all for being here, sharing your sitcom expertise with us. Listeners, I'll just remind you that at 2 o'clock today, WXXI has special programming of our podcast called Exited. That's a 5-part series about young people with disabilities transitioning into adult life, so check that out. My thanks to Rob Braden, our engineer, Tiana Manion, helping us out on phones. There's Rob for you. I'm Megan Mack. We'll talk to you tomorrow.